Lord, teach me how to pray that I might see. Lord, teach me what to say and set me free, that I may ever go at your command. Lord, teach me how to walk and hold your hand. Let not my will but thy, Lord, be done. And more like Jesus I would be. Lord, now to wait down on my knees, that I may know that you have heard my plea. Lord, teach me how to use my life for thee. Lord, teach me how to help the lost to see. Let not my will but thy, Lord, done. Jesus, I Lord, with you, Lord, teach me how to pray.
Welcome to another lesson from God's Word, brought to you by the Hamilton Church of Christ. In Matthew 27, verses 3 through 5, we read, "Then Judas, which had betrayed him, when he saw that he was condemned, repented himself, and brought again the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders, saying, I have sinned in that I have betrayed the innocent blood. And they said, What is that to us? See thou to that. And he cast down the pieces of silver in the temple, and departed, and went and hanged himself." Here we see that sin has a much different look after it's committed than it does before it's committed. Before it's done, it looks so glamorous and so glorious, and it's something we really desire to do. But after it's over, it leaves the stain of guilt. It leaves us in a sad state. We cannot be pleased with committing sin. So let's try to do all that we can to not commit sin, to keep our bodies free from sin. But if we do sin, then by all means, let's repent and get the forgiveness of God for the sin. Join us today as we study from the Bible.
I was groping in the darkness, searching vainly for a light. My heart was sick and heavy laden, my despair was black as night. Then I recalled the promise given by the Father in His Word. If we'd only ask believing, all our prayers would then be heard.
Ask in faith, I hear him say,
if I yield to him completely, he will hear me when I pray. Whatsoever he has promised, when to him I humbly plead, if I'll ask with nothing wavering, he will give me all my needs. Whatsoever, what a promise, if we follow day by day, always trusting, watching, praying, follow closely all the way. Then I pray, believing in him, not my will, but thine be done. And he brought me from the shadows back into the noonday sun.
Ask in faith, I hear him whisper.
Ask in faith, I hear him say,
if I yield to him completely,
he will hear me when I pray. Whatsoever he has promised, when to him I humbly plead, if I'll ask with nothing wavering, he will give me all my needs.
In our last study of Genesis, we've gotten through chapter 33, verse 19, but we have not yet talked about verse 20, which is the last verse. At this point, Jacob had come to Shechem. He and all of his large family and possessions had crossed the Jordan River. They were now in the land of Canaan proper. When Jacob arrived there, this city was controlled by the Hivites, a Canaanite tribe, whose chieftain was a man named Hamor. And Hamor had a son named Shechem, and possibly the city was named after him, or he was named after the city, one. But Jacob purchased the parcel of land from these people, and he pitched his tent here. And verse 20 says, and he erected there an altar, El Elo Israel. Jacob rightly considered this acquisition of his first property in Canaan to be an important milestone in his life. Accordingly, he wanted to first of all build an altar there, dedicating it to El Elo Israel, saying in effect that his God was the true and mighty God. God was the God of Israel. That's what this is saying. And it's significant that in naming the altar, he used for the first time, as far as the record indicates here, the new name Israel. There, in the center of an idolatrous land, he had established a new center of worship of the true God. And so now we see Jacob is established in this land of Canaan with the first altar, with the first, you might say, settlement of his people in that land. So this brings to a close chapter 33. We're now ready to move into chapter 34. We feel that Jacob and his family must have actually spent several years living in either Succoth or Shechem or both, because the events described in this next chapter, chapter 34, indicate that Leah's youngest child, Dinah, must have been at least in her teens, which means that her older brothers, especially Reuben, Simon, and Levi, must have been in their 20s. When they first moved to Succoth, Reuben was probably about 12 years old, so that the family must have lived at least 10 years in Succoth and Shechem, and most of the time was probably spent in Shechem. And it could have been longer than 10 years. Though the scripture does not mention it, it seems likely that during this time, Jacob must have visited Isaac and Esau on other occasions. And it wasn't necessary to record it, of course, since Jacob was the key person involved in God's plans, rather than either Isaac or Esau. And evidently, the writer felt it was unnecessary to include other personal matters of this sort. But as we move into chapter 34, we'd like to read the first verse. And Dinah, the daughter of Leah, which she bare unto Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. Here, Jacob and his family were living so close to an ungodly city, and it soon began to show the serious perils of a sort that Jacob really had not anticipated. You know, as we mingle with the people of the world, our family is going to pay a price for this, and it's real difficult to know how to know what's going to happen or how to prevent all the problems. As his children grew into their teens and then into adulthood, the low moral environment around them began to have its deadly effect. Living in a polygamous home with four different wives and mothers made it very difficult to maintain consistent and unified spiritual instruction, though no doubt Jacob made a serious and partially successful attempt to teach his children about God's great promises and the great calling that had been committed to them. Yet young people need companionship with others of their own age, of course, and this was bound to be true of those in Jacob's household, just like it is true in all of our households today. His 11 sons probably had enough fellowship just among themselves to satisfy their needs, but Dinah was the only daughter, at least for some time, at least for this time, and she must have longed for the opportunity to be with other girls of her own age. Evidently, the problem of finding suitable wives and husbands for his children had not yet become a serious problem for Jacob, since they were not really yet old enough, but Jacob and his wives must have been concerned about this. It probably would have been impossible to insist on mates being obtained from their own people, as Abraham and Isaac had done, since there were too many in the family and too few, if any, from whom they could choose. When you look at Laban's lapse in idolatry, which is a close member of the family there, you see it's difficult to find others that believe exactly like they did. They would sooner or later be forced to find mates for their children from the people of the land where they were living. And of course, it would certainly be better if these people could be won to the faith in this true God that Jacob and his family had through their example and their teaching to them. The immediate problem, however, was the need for a teenage feminine companion for Dinah. She had probably met some of the Shechemite girls and gotten to know them. This was a good in a way, but it also raised problems since their standards were quite different from those Jacob and Leah had tried to teach her. Whether she had become a bit rebellious against these standards is not mentioned, but it's certainly possible in view of the circumstances and in view of the nature of teens, even today, it's quite possible and common for them to go through a rebellious time, a time when they want to rebel against the teaching that we're given at home and want to do some experimentation on their own and be outside of the rim of their parental authority. In any case, Dinah, being now and then in the company of the Shechemite girls, could hardly have failed also to come to the attention of some of the Shechemite young men. It's hard to just stay with girls only and not have any men in the company at all. She must have seemed particularly attractive since she was of a different nationality, and she was no doubt possessed of a grace and charm that was not shared by girls raised in an atmosphere of idolatry and greed, such as was characterized by most Canaanite communities. So verses 2 through 4 say, "And when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her and defiled her. And his soul clave unto Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the damsel, and spake kindly unto the damsel. And Shechem spake unto his father Hamor, saying, Get me this damsel to wife. Dinah soon came to be desired by young Shechem, the son of Hamor, the city's chieftain. Unattached young women were considered fair game in the cities of that time, in which promiscuity was not only common, but, in fact, it was a part of the very religious system itself. It seems likely that Dinah must have been warned about such dangers by her parents, but perhaps she felt she could look out for herself and may have resented their overprotective attitude. To what extent she may actually have encouraged Shechem, who must have seemed a rather glamorous figure to young girls like Dinah, is not stated, but in any case, it was only a matter of time until she had been seduced by Shechem while she was visiting some of her girlfriends in the city. Shechem may or may not have actually forced her, but in view of her age, it was at least a case of what today would be called statutory rape. With Shechem, however, it was not merely a case of routine conquest, as no doubt often was true in such a place, for he really had fallen in love with Dinah, and he wanted her to become his wife. After he had seduced her, he did not cast her aside, but he tried to comfort her and assured her that he loved her and would marry her. In fact, verse 26 says that he took her into his own house and he kept her there. But here verse 3 says that he loved the damsel and spake kindly unto the damsel. Now, that does not indicate that he was really using a force and doing something that much against Dinah's will, but he did seduce her, but he tried to comfort her when it was over. But in this day and time, marriage was not as easy to accomplish as a simple sexual adventure was. In those days, even among pagans, marriage had to be arranged by the parents. Consequently, Shechem asked his father to take the necessary steps with Dinah's father to obtain Dinah as his wife. It's an interesting commentary on the Shechemite culture to note that Hamor apparently thought nothing about the moral implications of what his son had done. And it's very shocking as we think of our society today, many, many parents in our society today would think the very same thing. They would even arrange for their sons or daughters to have these relationships, and even put them on things like birth control pills to protect them from pregnancy while doing this. I mean, it's shocking if you think about the Shechemites doing it, but it's right in our culture today also. The father didn't rebuke Shechem. He did not apologize in any way to Dinah or Dinah's brothers. For a young man to lie with a young woman, even by force, was apparently such a common thing in Canaanite towns that no one gave it a second thought, much like our society today, unfortunately. Verse 5 says, "And Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah his daughter. Now his sons were with his cattle in the field, and Jacob held his peace until they came." Word Jacob concerning what had happened, probably by way of some of her girlfriend. Jacob no doubt was looking and angry, just as her godly father should be. But he decided not to do anything with talking with Dinah's brother, still out in the field with the cattle. He probably regretted settling down so close to a place like Shechem. He probably now really did not like this community at all, where it would be almost impossible not to have his children subjected to bad influences. On the other hand, where else in Canaan would it have been better? He needed to pray and trust God more. And he must have felt that he had fallen short. But this is a very common feeling for parents to have, and it does not necessarily mean that Jacob had fallen short. There comes a time in the life of every child when they're going to be in a position to make a decision, and the parent can't be there to make them decide one way or the other. Every child is going to be put into a position where sooner or later he or she will be making decisions as to what's right and what's wrong. And although parents have done their very best to know to raise them, sometimes the child's going to make a rebellious decision that goes against what the parent taught. Jacob needed to pray and trust God more, sure. And he needed to do more to help his children to live victoriously in a pagan world. This doesn't mean work less, it means work harder. But now he had a problem that had to be dealt with. What to do about the immediate situation? This was the problem, and he didn't know the answer. Like most today, parents in this position do not really know the answer. It's very difficult. But verses 6 and 7 say, "And Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out unto Jacob to commune with him. And the sons of Jacob came out of the field when they heard it, and the men were grieved, and they were very wroth, because he had wrought folly in Israel in lying with Jacob's daughter, which thing ought not to be done." While Jacob was waiting for his sons to come home, pondering and grieving about the situation, Hamor appeared at his house with the proposal that Dinah be given to Shechem's wife. No word of apology or sympathy was offered, not to say I'm sorry or regret that this thing happened. No suggestion that his son would be punished in any way. He merely suggested a proposition of marriage. And as this conversation between Jacob and Hamor was taking place, the sons of Jacob came bursting into the room. They had also heard the story by now, and they were grieved and bitterly angry. Dinah had been the only and the very beloved sister in a large family of boys, and they'd all been taught about the sacredness of the marriage relationship. Even though they had been raised in a polygamous household, at least Jacob had not sought women other than his wives, and his wives had been faithful to him. They all knew of God's purpose to raise up a holy nation through their family, and that the maintenance of national integrity and purity was essential to assure God's continued blessing on them. Not only did they resent the affair for Dinah's sake, but because Shechem had wrought folly in Israel, disrupting that natural purity which they had regarded as so vital. And the use of the name Israel here in this connection indicates that they must have had some deep feeling and recognition of the deeper values and implications of this event, what this would do to the house of Israel, what this would do to the name of Israel, and so forth. Verses 8 through 12 say, "And Hamor communed with them, saying, The soul of my son Shechem longeth for your daughter. I pray you, give her him to wife. And make ye marriages with us, and give your daughters unto us, and take our daughters unto you, and ye shall dwell with us, and the land shall be before you. Dwell and trade ye therein, and get ye possessions therein. And Shechem said unto her father and her brethren, Let me find grace in your eyes, and what you shall say unto me, I will give. Ask me never so much dowry and gift, and I will give according as ye shall say unto me, but give me the damsel to wife." So their anger made little impression on Hamor, however, as he continued urging them to accept his proposition. But not only was he proposing that Shechem take Dinah, but suddenly he began to make a much broader suggestion. He suggested here that there be a general intermarrying between the people of Israel and those of Shechem. And although he didn't say so openly, he was thinking that since his own people were far more numerous than those of Israel, this would be a fine way of quickly taking them in among their nation and taking over their possessions. And so Shechem himself, who had evidently come with his father but had remained very silent to this point, he eagerly offered to pay Jacob and his sons whatever they would require in the way of a dowry and other gifts. It seems obvious that he really did love Dinah, and he was very interested in having her than his father's concern was for getting these two nations together. He did not seem to feel any pains of conscience for what he'd done to her or for the terrible offense to her family. And verse 13 says, "And the sons of Jacob answered Shechem and Hamor his father deceitfully and said, Because he hath defiled Dinah their sister." Now, quite possibly it was this matter-of-fact businesslike attitude of Hamer and Shechem that infuriated Dinah's brothers beyond limit. Here these men were making a monetary offer for their beloved sister, just as though she were nothing but a harlot whose body could be purchased for the asking, which is referred to in verse 31. Verses 14 through 17 say, "And they said unto them, We cannot do this thing, to give our sister to one that is uncircumcised, for that were a reproach unto us. But in this will we consent unto you, if you will be as we be, that every male of you be circumcised, then will we give our daughters unto you, and we will take your daughters unto us, and we will dwell with you, and we will become one people. But if you will not hearken unto us to be circumcised, then will we take our daughter, and we will be gone." From this point on, the sons of Jacob did all the talking with Hamer. Evidently, Jacob was so distressed that he either left the room or he was just unable to continue the discussion himself. Whether these sons of Jacob were only Simon and Levi, or whether Reuben and Judah and others were also involved, is not stated. Later, it was Simon and Levi, though, who took revenge on the Shechemites, but there's a possibility that some of the others participated in the plot, which here begins to develop. While Hamer and Shechem were talking, the sons of Jacob devised a plan of vengeance, which involved both blasphemy and murder, as well as deception and cruelty. Verse 13 says, "And the sons of Jacob answered Shechem and Hamer his father deceitfully." And so they're saying things here that are not truthful. They're not following the true intent of what they're implying, and they're being deceptive with this. Such a shocking plan was justified in their own minds because of what they considered to be intolerable sin against their sister and against their name. Now, you know, when we had a crime like this committed against us or against a member of our family, rage takes over. We begin to plan things in our imagination, things of terrible vengeance, as how to get revenge on others. Maybe defiling their body some way or defacing their body some way or in the case of rape, somebody gets the idea that they won't even castrate the person or whatever to get back at them. And so these sons here evidently had these feelings right now. And so they were plotting a deceptive plan against the Shechemites. Not content to take vengeance against Shechem only, they felt, and they were probably correct in this, that in a sense the whole city was guilty and deserved judgment, just as God had judged Sodom and Gomorrah in the days of their great-grandfather. No one in the city had protested Shechem's behavior toward their sister. No one had tried to protect her. And in fact, they had seemed rather pleased when Shechem's conquest of the beautiful young foreign girl. No doubt the other young men of this city would have done the same if it had the opportunity. But Shechem, as their prince, he had first priority. And they got some kind of pleasure just from learning about his sexual exploits. So not content to leave the city's judgment, if it be deserved, in the hands of God, as in the time of Sodom, Simon and Levi, in particular, resolved to take it into their own hands. Now, you know, today, the teaching for us is that we're to let God do this. God says, "Vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord." It's not our place to take personal vengeance against those who've done harm to us. God will take care of us. But not so here in the case of these brothers. They did not look at it this way. They were going to take vengeance themselves. So pretending to go along with Hamer's proposition that there would be a general intermarriage between the two peoples with consequent commercial advantages to both sides, they said that the only problem was a religious one. It was their religious conviction that every male in their own nation should be circumcised. And if indeed they were from that time on to be one people, then the Shechemites would also need to be circumcised. Otherwise, they would have to take Dinah back and keep the two peoples completely segregated in the future. Whether their other brothers knew about the murderous plan or not, the Bible is not clear here, but it was Simon and Levi who actually carried it out, and they definitely were involved in the plot that's going on right now. Let us read verses 18 through 22 now. "And their words pleased Hamer and Shechem, Hamer's son, and the young man deferred not to do the thing, because he had delight in Jacob's daughter, and he was more honorable than all the house of his father. And Hamer and Shechem, his son, came unto the gate of their city, and communed with the men of their city, saying, These men are peaceful with us. Therefore let them dwell in the land, and trade therein, for the land, behold, it is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters to us for wives, and let us give them our daughters. Only herein will the men consent unto us, for to dwell with us, to be one people, if every male among us be circumcised, and as they are circumcised. So the unsuspecting Shechemites readily agreed to this proposition, beginning first of all with Shechem himself, who had no hesitation in submitting himself to the surgical rite of circumcision because he loved Dinah. There were certain other nations besides the Israelites who had practiced circumcision in early times, so that the terms of the agreement didn't sound too strange or offensive to the men of Shechem. Hamor gathered them all together at the city's gate and laid the whole proposition before them, stressing that they would eventually own all the property of the Israelites as well as have access to their women. The men of Shechem were easily persuaded by such inducements. They would be willing to go along with this particular religious notion to gain such wealth, especially since there was nothing in their own carnal religion that would prevent it. Shechem's example further encouraged them. He was held in considerable esteem among them. Verse 19 says literally that he was more honored than any in his father's house. So this great honored person, he did this. So finally they all agreed to the terms and agreed to be circumcised. The day was set, all of the work was stopped, and all the men from Hamor and Shechem on down allowed themselves to be circumcised. So what a great deceptive act this is for the sons of Jacob to make this kind of a proposition to the people of Shechem, and the Shechemites bought it hook, line, and sinker. They thought this was a great thing, and it was really one big deception. It was really a murderous plot. And all this time, Jacob was saying nothing that we read about, and we can't believe he was at all pleased with this set of circumstances, but it seems to be out of his hands at the moment as his sons are taken over in the emotion of the moment and the highly charged thoughts that they were having due to this terrible thing that had been done to Dinah, and this is the circumstance. Well, we must close our lesson at that point. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying goodbye, friends.
Sometimes in this life
we have struggles and strife,
and some things we do not understand. Tears are shed, but go up ahead. When at last we get home, trying, we still have faith in God's mighty plan. We know he can do what he said.
Yes, he can.
Let's lift our cross and let's carry on. With Christ by our side, carry on.
We miss those gone on, and we sometimes feel alone.
It can seem no one else really cares. God up above, through his great matchless love, sends us help because he hears our prayers. We still have faith in God's mighty plan. We know he can do what he said.
Yes, he can.
Let's lift our cross and let's carry on. With Christ by our side, carry on.
and know the things of God. In Isaiah, the 55th chapter, Isaiah says, "Seek ye the Lord while he may be found. Call ye upon him while he is near. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." So won't you take